Welcome to Anatomy and the Art of Healing. Today we will learn about the classification of bones. Bones are classified according to the shape and size. The long bones, each long bone, it has an elongated shaft that's called as diaphysis. And it has two expanded ends called as epiphysis, which are smooth and articular. The shaft typically has three surfaces separated by three borders. It has a central medullary cavity and a nutrient foramen directed away from the growing end. For example, the typical bones like humerus, radius, ulna, femur, tibia, and fibula. Miniature long bones have only one epiphysis, like metacarpals, metatarsals, phalanges, and modified bones. The modified long bones have no medullary cavity. For example, the clavicle, it has no medullary cavity. Then there are the short bones. Their shape, it is usually cuboid, cuneiform, trapezoid, and scaphoid. These are the carpal bones and the tarsal bones. Flat bones, these resemble shallow plates and they form boundaries of certain body cavities, like the bones of the vault of skull, ribs, sternum, and scapula. Then there are the irregular bones like the vertebra, the hip bone, the bones in the base of the skull. The pneumatic bones. The pneumatic bones, these are irregular bones which have large air spaces which are lined by epithelium. For example, the maxilla, sphenoid, ethmoid, these bones are placed in the skull and the facial bones, and they make the skull light in weight, and they help in the resonance of the voice and act as air conditioning chambers for the inspired air. Then there are the sesamoid bones, and these are somewhat like bony nodules which are found embedded in the tendons or the joint capsules. These have no periosteum and they ossify after birth. They are related to some articular surface or non-articular bony surface, and the surfaces of contact, they are covered with hyaline cartilage and lubricated by a bursa or synovial membrane. For example, the patella, pisiform, fabula, these are sesamoid bones. The functions of sesamoid bones, these are to resist the pressure, to minimize the friction between the bones or friction between the external surface with the bone, and it alters the direction of the pull of the muscle. Also, it maintains the local circulation. Then there are the accessory supernumerary bones. These are usually not always present, but they may occur as ununited epiphyses which are developed from extra centers of ossification, like the sutural bones, os trigonum, lateral tubercle of talus, os vesalianum, that is the tuberosity, present at the tuberosity of the fifth metatarsal. It's important medico-legally because in medico-legal practice, accessory bones sometimes can be mistaken for fractures. But one has to understand that these are present bilaterally and they have smooth surfaces without any callus. Then there are the heterotopic bones. These bones sometimes develop in the soft tissues. The horse riders, They develop these bones in the adductor muscles, the adductor muscles in the medial aspect of the thigh, and these are called as the rider's bones also. Then the bones are also classified developmentally. The membranous bones is as you ossify in the membrane. Also, this kind of ossification is called as intramembranous ossification or mesenchymal ossification. And this ossification, the name has been derived because of the mesenchymal condensations. For example, the bones of the vault of the skull and the facial bones, they develop from the mesenchymal condensations. Cartilaginous bones ossify in cartilage. That's why it's called as intracartilaginous or endochondral ossification. And derived from the preformed cartilaginous models. For example, the bones of the limbs, vertebral column and thoracic cage. Membranocartilaginous bones, they ossify partly in membrane and partly in cartilage. That's why the name membranocartilaginous bone. For example, the clavicle, mandible, occipital, temporal bone and sphenoid bones, these are some of the membranocartilaginous bones which are partly membranous and partly cartilaginous. Then the somatic bones. These bones are somatic. And visceral bones, these develop from the pharyngeal arches during the developmental stages. And examples of the pharyngeal bones developing from pharyngeal arches are ethmoid bones, part of the mandible, and ear ossicles. Finally, we have the regional classification. The regional classification is axial skeleton and the appendicular skeleton. Axial skeleton includes the skull, vertebral column and thoracic cage, whereas the appendicular skeleton, it includes the bones of the upper limb and the lower limb. Then coming to the structural classification, it's classified as compact and cancellous. The compact bone is dense in texture, like ivory, but it is extremely porous inside, and it is best developed in the cortex of the long bones. This is a kind of adaptation to bending and twisting forces, that is a combination of compression, tension and shear pressure. The second thing is the cancellous or spongy bone or trabecular bone, which is open in texture and it is made up of meshwork of trabeculae, which consists of rods and plates, and between which there is the marrow containing spaces. These trabecular meshworks are of three primary types. One is the meshwork of rods. It can be meshwork of rods and plates, and it can be meshwork of plates. This cancellous bone, it is an adaptation to compressive forces. So these bones are marvelously constructed to combine strength, elasticity and lightness to the weight. Even though the architecture of the bone may be modified by mechanical forces, the form of the bone is primarily determined by heredity. Coming to the Wolff's law, it is also called as trajectory theory of Wolff. The bone formation is directly proportional to stress and strain. So there are two forces, the tensile and the compressive force, and both these forces can stimulate bone formation in the proper conditions. The architecture of the cancellous bone is often interpreted in the terms of trajectorial theory. Thus, the arrangement of bony trabeculae is governed by the lines of maximal internal stress in the bone. These pressure lamellae, these are arranged parallelly to the line of weight transmission. Whereas the tension lamellae, these are arranged in the right angles to the pressure lamellae. And the compact arrangement of these pressure lamellae form a kind of bony buttress. It is for the additional support. For example, the calcare femoral, which is present near the angle of the femur, neck of the femur, it gives additional support to the angle of the neck so that it won't break off, and it gives additional strength to the neck of the femur. Microscopically, the bone is of five types, like the lamellar, which contains both compact and cancellous. It may be woven, fibrous, dentine, and cementine. Coming to the lamellar type of bone, most of the major human bones, whether compact or cancellous, are composed of thin plates of bony tissue, and these bony tissue, these are called as the lamellae. And these lamellae are arranged in piles in a cancellous bone, but in the compact bone, you'll find that these lamellae are in form of concentric cylinders. And this type of arrangement, it's called as Haversian system or secondary ostium. Then we have the woven bone. The woven bone, it's seen in the fetal bone in kind of the fracture repair and in cancer of bone. Third type is the fibrous bone. Fibrous bone is found in young fetal bones, and these are common in reptiles and amphibia also. Then we have the dentine and the cementine, which occur in the teeth. Coming to the gross structure of an adult long bone, when you do a naked eye examination of the longitudinal and transverse sections of a long bone, it shows the shaft. The shaft, when you find the gross structure from without inside, outwards to inwards, it is composed of periosteum, cortex, and medullary cavity. Periosteum, it is a thick fibrous membrane which covers the surface of the bone, and it is made up of outer fibrous layer and an inner cellular layer which is osteogenic in nature. Periosteum is united to the underlying bone by means of Sharpe's fibers, and the union is particularly strong over the attachments of tendons and ligaments. At the articular margin of the periosteum, it's continuous with the capsule of the bone, that is near the joint. The abundant periosteal arteries are present here, which nourish the outer part of the underlying cortex also. This periosteum, it has rich nerve supply, which makes it the most sensitive part of the bone. Then the cortex, it is made up of compact bone, which gives it the desired strength to withstand all the possible mechanical strains. Inside, there is the medullary cavity, which is filled with red or yellow bone marrow. And at birth, the marrow is red everywhere with the widespread active hemophysis. As the age advances, the red marrow at many places atrophies, and it is replaced by yellow fatty marrow, and there is no power of hemopoiesis then. A red bone marrow, it persists in the cancellous ends of the long bone and in the ribs, sternum, iliac crest, vertebrae, skull bones. The red bone marrow is found throughout the life. The two ends of a long bone, these are made up of cancellous bone covered with hyaline articular cartilage. Coming to the parts of a young bone, typically a long bone, it ossifies in three parts. The two ends of that long bone, they ossify from the secondary centers, whereas the intervening shaft, it ossifies from a primary center. So before ossification is complete, the parts of the bone are formed, that is the epiphysis, the ends and the tips of a bone which ossify from secondary centers are called as epiphysis. They can be pressure epiphysis, which is articular and takes part in the transmission of the weight. For example, the head of the femur, the lower end of the radius. Then there is the traction epiphysis. It is non-articular and it does not take part in the transmission of weight. It always provides attachment to one or more tendons which exert a traction to or to the epiphysis. This traction epiphysis ossifies later in life than the pressure epiphysis. For example, the trochanters of femur, the tubercles of humerus. The ataphistic epiphysis, it is phylogenetically an independent bone which in a man becomes fused to another bone. For example, the coracoid process of scapula and os trigonum or lateral tubercle of talus, these are the atavistic epiphysis. Aberrant epiphysis is not always present. For example, the epiphysis at the head of first metacarpal and at the base of other metacarpal bones are the aberrant epiphysis, but these are not usually seen always. Diaphysis, it is a long shaft, that is the elongated shaft of the long bone, which ossifies from a primary center. Then you have the metaphysis, this the epiphyseal ends of the diaphysis, it's called as the metaphysis. So each metaphysis, it's the zone of active growth. Before epiphyseal fusion, the metaphysis is richly supplied with blood through end arteries. And these end arteries, they form hairpin bends. It's a common site of osteomyelitis in children because bacteria or emboli are easily trapped in the hairpin bends, which cause infarction. After the epiphyseal fusion, vascular communications get established between the metaphyseal and epiphyseal arteries, and the metaphysis contains no more end arteries because they are already fused. And then it is no longer subjected to osteomyelitis. Next is the epiphyseal plate of cartilage. It separates the epiphysis from metaphysis, and proliferation of cells in this cartilaginous plate is responsible for the lengthwise growth of a long bone. After the epiphyseal fusion, the bone can no longer grow in length, and the growth cartilage is nourished by both the epiphyseal and the metaphyseal arteries. Coming to the blood supply of the bones, the long bones, they are supplied by nutrient arteries and it enters the shaft through nutrient foramen. It runs oblique through the cortex and divides into ascending and descending branches in the medullary cavity. Each of the nutrient artery divides into number of small channels which lie parallelly, and then they terminate into adult metaphysis by anastomosing with the epiphyseal, metaphyseal and the periosteal arteries. The nutrient artery supplies medullary cavity, inner two-thirds of cortex and metaphysis. The nutrient foramen is directed away from the growing end of the bone. But these directions are indicated by a jingle, so you can remember the direction. The jingle goes this way. To the elbow I go, from the knee I flee. So that indicates the growing ends of the bones in the upper limb are the upper end of the humerus and the lower ends of radius and ulna. And in the lower limb, the lower end of femur and the upper end of tibia are the growing ends. Then there are the periosteal arteries. These are many in number, situated beneath the muscular and the ligamentous attachments. They branch and ramify, and they are placed beneath the periosteum, and then they enter the Walkman's canals to supply to the one-third, outer one-third of the cortex. The epiphyseal arteries, these are derived from the periarticular vascular arcades. These are found near the non-articular bony surfaces. And out of the numerous vascular foramina in this region, only a few admit the arteries, just the epiphyseal and the metaphyseal arteries. And rest of the openings are just venous exits. The number and the size of these foramen can give an idea of the vascularity at the ends of the long bone. Next is the metaphyseal arteries. These metaphyseal arteries are derived from the neighboring systemic vessels, and they pass directly into the metaphyses and reinforce the metaphyseal branches from the primary nutrient artery. In miniature long bones, the infections, if it begins in the middle of the shaft rather than at the metaphyses, it's because the nutrient artery breaks into plexus immediately upon reaching the medullary cavity. So in adults, the chances of infection are minimized because the nutrient artery is mostly replaced by the periosteal vessels. Some other bones, like short bones, are supplied by numerous periosteal vessels which enter their non-articular surfaces. In a vertebra, the body is supplied by anterior and posterior vessels, and the vertebral arch is supplied by large vessels which enters the basis of the transverse processes. The marrow is drained by two large basivertebral veins. A rib, it is supplied by a nutrient artery which enters it just beyond the tubercle. Then the periosteal arteries are also present. Veins are numerous and they are large in the cancellous red marrow containing bones. For example, basivertebral veins. And in the compact bone, they accompany the arteries in the Walkman's canals. Lymphatics are also there. They accompany the periosteal blood vessels which drain to the regional lymph nodes. Coming to the nerve supply of the bones, nerves also accompany the blood vessels, and most of them are sympathetic and vasomotor in function. A few of them are sensory, which distribute to the articular ends and periosteum of the long bones, to the vertebra and to large flat bones. That's about the classification of bones. Next, we'll study about the development and ossification of the bones. Dr. Rajeshwari Tapata signing off until we meet again in the next episode. Stay tuned to learn more. Hello all, today we learn about development and ossification of bones. Bones are first laid down as mesodermal, that is connective tissue condensations. Conversion of mesodermal modules into bone is called intramembranous or mesenchymal ossification. And these bones are called membrane bones or dermal bones. However, mesodermal stage may pass through cartilaginous stage by chondrification during the second month of intrauterine life. This conversion of cartilaginous model into bone is called as intracartilaginous or endochondral ossification. And such bones are called cartilaginous bones. Ossification takes place by centers of ossification, and each one of which is a point where laying down of lamellae, that is bone formation, starts by the osteoblasts situated on the newly formed capillary loops.
So there are the layers of bone material forming. The centers of ossification may be primary or secondary. These secondary centers appear before birth and usually during 8th week of intrauterine life. The secondary centers, they appear after birth with some exceptions, like at the lower end of femur, upper end of tibia. Many secondary centers appear during puberty also. A primary center, it forms the diaphysis, the shaft, and the secondary centers, they form the epiphysis. The fusion of epiphysis with the diaphysis starts at puberty and it gets completed by the age of 25 years, after which there is no bone growth which can take place. The law of ossification, it states that secondary centers of ossification which appear first are last to unite. Remember this. The end of a long bone where the epiphyseal fusion is delayed is called the growing end of the bone. Coming to the growth of a long bone. The bone, it grows in the length by multiplication of cells in the epiphyseal plate of cartilage. Bones grow in thickness by multiplication of cells in the deeper layer of periosteum. And bones grow by deposition of new bone on the surface and at the ends. This process of bone deposition by osteoblasts is called appositional growth or surface accretion. However, in order to maintain the shape, the unwanted bone must be removed. So this process of bone removal by osteoblasts is called as remodeling. And this is how bone marrow cavity increases in size. This process of bone removal by osteoblasting is called as remodeling. And you have to remember these two terms. That is the appositional growth, that is surface accretion, and the remodeling. Now coming to the medico-legal and anthropological aspects of the skeleton. When a skeleton or isolated bones are received for medico-legal examinations, one should be able to determine whether the bones are human or not. Second thing, whether they belong to one person or more persons. The age of the individual should be determined, the sex of the individual, the stature, and the time and the cause of death is also determined. Coming to the estimation of the skeletal age up to the age of 25 years, the skeletal age can be estimated to within 1 to 2 years of correct age by the states of dentition, by the ossification, if the whole skeleton is available. From 25 years onwards, the skeletal age can be estimated to within plus or minus 5 years of the correct age by the state of cranial sutures and of the bony surfaces of the symphysis pubis. So in general, the appearance of secondary centers and fusion of epiphyses, it occurs about 1 year earlier in females than in males. And these events are also believed to occur 1 to 2 years. So the medico-legal aspects are also studied in the forensic medicine. Now this is all for today. But the skeletal system is not still completed without the cartilage and joints. So next episode we'll discuss about cartilage, different types of cartilage, joints, and different types of joints. This is Dr. Rajeshwari Rapata signing off until we meet again in the next episode. Stay tuned till then.
I'm Dr. Rajeshwari Rapata and I welcome you to Anatomy at the Art of Healing podcast. as promised in the last episode, I'm here with more learnings on cartilages and joints. Let us see what are cartilages. Cartilages, these are the synonym of the cartilage. We have the chondros in Greek, gristle. Then comparing it with the terms called as chondrification, chondrodystrophy, synchondrosis. So this term chondro is almost is there with all the terms that refers to the chondrocytes, which are the most the component of the cartilage. The definition: cartilage is a connective tissue composed of the cells, that is the chondrocytes, and fibers, which are the collagen or the yellow elastic cartilage, which are embedded in the firm gel-like matrix. So these fibers consisting of collagen or yellow elastic fibers, which are seen embedded in the fiber gel-like matrix, which is rich in the mucopolysaccharides. It is much more elastic than the bones. Coming to the general features of the cartilage. Cartilage, it has no blood vessels or lymphatics, and the nutrition of the cells diffuses through the matrix. Then the cartilage has no nerves, therefore it is very insensitive. Cartilage is surrounded by the fibrous membrane called perichondrium, which is similar to the periosteum in nature in the structure and function. So perichondrium covers the cartilage and periosteum covers the bone. And the cartilage, the articular cartilage, that is at the joints, it has no perichondrium. So that its regeneration after the injury, it is the most inadequate. That's why joints, when they are eroded, the articular cartilage, as it has no perichondrium, its regeneration is very inadequate. When cartilage calcifies, the chondrocytes die and the cartilage is replaced by bone-like tissue, so it hardens. Coming to the cartilage and the bone comparison, the bone is hard whereas the cartilage is firm. Matrix in the bone has inflexible material. It has chondroitin in the cartilage, providing the flexibility, and in the bone there is the osteine. Matrix possesses calcium salts and bone, whereas in the cartilage the calcium salts are not present. Bone has rich nerve supply and it is vascular nature, but cartilage does not have the nerve supply and it is avascular in nature. Coming to the bone marrow, it's present in the bones, whereas in the cartilage the bone marrow is absent. Growth in the bone is happens by apposition, whereas in the cartilage it is appositional and interstitial as well. So surface deposition also happens, and from within also the deposition growth happens. Now the different types of cartilages. Different types. There are the three types of cartilages, and these three types of cartilages are the hyaline cartilage, fibrocartilage, and elastic cartilage. So these three cartilages, when coming to the comparison of these three cartilages, you'll find that the hyaline cartilage, it is located in the articular cartilages of the long bones. So at the ends where the joints form, you'll find the hyaline cartilage. Also at the sternum, the ribs, the nasal bones, and some of the laryngeal joints where the articulation forms, the hyaline cartilage is always present. The color of this cartilage is bluish white, and it has shiny translucent fibers which are very thin and have almost same refractive fibers and the index are somewhat same as the matrix. So these are not so seen because as they are very thin and almost have the same refractive index. The elasticity of the hyaline cartilage, it is flexible. Now coming to the fibrocartilage, it is present in the intervertebral discs of pubic symphysis, temporomandibular joints, sternoclavicular joints, and the color of this fibrocartilage is glistening white, shiny. The appearance of it's opaque and has numerous white fibers. The elasticity is more firm and the strongest. The elastic cartilage, coming to the elastic cartilage, you'll find it is present in the pinna, that is pinna of the ear, and the external auditory meatus, the canal, ear canal, and the eustachian tubes and epiglottis, the vocal process of arytenoid cartilages, and the color is yellowish and the appearance is opaque. It contains numerous yellow fibers, and elasticity, it's the most flexible in the elasticity. Now coming to the clinical anatomy of these cartilages, there can be a defect in the membranous ossification, and thus it may cause a rare syndrome called as dysostosis, and that dysostosis affects the clavicles and the skull. So cleidocranial dysostosis it is called as, and it is characterized by three cardinal features, and this can present with the varying degrees of aplasia of the clavicles. Either there can be increase in the transverse diameter of the cranium. There can be retardation in the fontanelle ossification. So as it affects the cranium and the clavicle, it is called as cleidocranial dysostosis. Now this may be either hereditary or environmental in origin. Another condition which happens is a defect in the endochondral ossification, which causes a common type of dwarfism called as achondroplasia, where you will find that the limbs are short, the trunk is almost normal, and it is transmitted as a Mendelian dominant character. Then periosteum. About the periosteum, you find the periosteum is particularly sensitive because of the nerve supply. So if there is a tearing or tension happens, there will be extreme pain. So drilling into the compact bone without anesthesia can cause mild pain or aching sensation. But if you drill into a spongy bone, then you'll find it will be much more painful. Therefore, fractures, tumors, infections of the bone are very painful. The blood supply to the bone, it's very rich, so it has enough amount of blood supply, and that is why it is very difficult to interrupt it. And if you interrupt that, it may kill the bone. So passing a metal pin into the medullary cavity, you will find that hardly it interferes with the blood supply of the bone, as it is so deep inside. Then the fracture, if a fracture happens, what is a fracture? Fracture is a break in the continuity of the bone. The fracture which is not connected with the skin wound. So suppose it is not open, okay, and it is not connected and seen on the surface. That will be called as a simple closed fracture. And the fracture line, it can be either oblique or horizontal. So the fractures which communicate with the skin wound, it's called as open fracture or compound fracture if multiple breaches are there in the continuity. And a fracture which requires reduction, by which the alignment of the broken ends are restored. So that's the process by which the reduction can happen. So both the broken ends are made to align with each other, and that is called a reduction of a fracture. Now coming to the healing of the fracture. The healing or repair of a fracture, it takes place in three stages. That can be the repair by granulation tissue, union by the callus, consolidation by the major bone. So these three stages will be seen. Then axis, or the second cervical vertebra, that can also get fractured. So If the dents of the fracture get separated from the body, it will hit the vital centers in the medulla oblongata. That can cause instantaneous death, that which happens during the hanging or death by hanging. So even a fracture of the lamina can also cause death. That's because of the compression on the spinal cord, medulla oblongata. Now in the rickets, that's a deficiency of the vitamin D. So calcification of cartilage fails and ossification of the growth zone is also disturbed. And this rickets affects the growing bones, and therefore you'll find that the disease develops during the period of the most rapid growth of skeleton, that is 3 months of age to 3 years. So in this age, if you find that there is a calcium, the deficiency of vitamin D, there is the tendency to rickets to develop. So osteoid tissue is formed normally and the cartilage cells proliferate freely, but mineralization does not take place because of the deficiency. And this will result into craniotapes or rachitic rosary at the costochondral joints. Costochondral means, that is, ribs and the cartilages. At that place you will find there will be bulgings. So all the bulgings, they will look like a rosary. That's why it's called as rachitic rosary. Harrison's sulcus at the diaphragmatic attachments. So grooving can also be seen. And enlarged epiphysis in the limb bones and spinal and pelvic deformities will also be seen in the rickets. For the proper development of bones, a child requires adequate amounts of proteins, calcium and vitamin D and other nutrition products. Now, deficiency of the calcium and vitamin D in the growing children leads to widening of the ends of the bones with inadequate ossification. This condition that's what is called as rickets. Coming to another deficiency, that is the deficiency of vitamin C in scurvy, formation of the collagenous fibers and the matrix gets impaired. So here, defective formation of the intercellular cementing substances, lack of the collagen cause, these will cause rupture of the capillaries and defective formation of new capillaries. That is why you find that there will be bleeding from the gums, isn't it? So bleeding from the gums is one of the main symptoms which you find in scurvy. So bleeding disorders, hematoma in the muscles and bones causing severe pain and tenderness. So also the normal architecture of the growing ends of the bones gets lost. So that's how scurvy also affects the bones and causes the hemorrhage. Many skeletal defects are caused by genetic factors or by combination of genetic, hormonal, nutritional and pathological factors. The vertebral arch or the laminae of the vertebral column may also remain deficient. The spinal cord may be covered by skin, as seen in the spina bifida occulta. There may be protrusion of the meninges around the spinal cord, surrounding the spinal cord, placed in the vertebral column. That condition is called as meningosis. Or there may be protrusion of the spinal cord as well as meninges in a condition called as meningomyelosis. If the deficiency of calcium, vitamin D occurs in the adult life, it leads to osteomalacia. So this is another condition because of the deficiency of calcium and vitamin D. So osteomalacia, where there is a deficiency. The bones on the x-ray examinations do not reveal enough of the trabeculate in this condition. And deficiency of calcium in the bones in the old age may lead to osteoporosis. There is a porous occurrence you find. So osteoporosis, and it is seen both in males and females. Due to osteoporosis, there is a forward bending of the vertebral column. It can lead to kyphosis, and also it can lead to fractures, easy fractures. And mostly in females, it is seen during the menopausal age, after crossing the menopausal age, where there is a calcium metabolism becomes weaker. And nerves are also closely related to the bones in some areas. So you'll find that fractures of the bones in those areas may also lead to the injury to the nerves. And it can lead to the paralysis of the muscles which are supplied by those nerves, and also sensory loss can be found. Now coming to the bone marrow biopsy. Bone marrow can be taken either from the mammogram sternum or iliac crest. In various clinical conditions, it is necessary to do the investigations and withdraw the bone marrow and send it after doing the biopsy. So mammogram sternum and iliac crest, because it is easily seen through the surface and can be approached to the surface of the skin. So these two bones are most commonly preferred. Then coming to the bone tumors, there are the benign and the malignant tumors which can occur in the bones. So all these things are basic things, but these will be discussed in the surgery subject in detail. While you're studying the anatomy, you're supposed to understand what abnormalities commonly occur in these structures. Now coming to the joints. Joints related terms are the arthron, which also refers to, in Greek it's called as arthron, and it's compared to the joint. Comparing these terms also with arthrology, synarthrosis, diarthrosis, arthritis, arthrodesis. So these have different meanings, but all these terms are related to the joints. When you say articulation, that also means a joint. Junctura is also a joint. Syndesmology or syndesmosis refers to ligaments near the joint. So it's a study of the ligaments and the related joints, syndesmology. Coming to the definition of a joint, joint is a junction between two or more bones or cartilages. So it is a device to permit movements. However, there are some immovable joints also, which are primarily meant for growth, and they also permit molding during the childbirth. There are more joints in a child than in an adult, because as growth proceeds, some of these bones fuse together. For example, you take the ilium, the ischium, the pubis, which form the pelvic bones. The two halves of the infant frontal bone and the infant mandible, the five sacral vertebrae or the four coccygeal vertebrae. All these in the infant, they are in different parts, but as the baby grows into an adult, they fuse together. Coming to the classification of joints, joints are classified into many types of different subtypes. Like fibrous joints, they are sutural, syndesmosis, romphosis. Then this is the structural classification. So fibrous joints into sutural, syndesmosis and romphosis. Whereas when you come to the cartilaginous joints, they are the primary cartilaginous joints or synchondrosis. Then the secondary cartilaginous joints or symphysis. The third type is the synovial joints. Synovial joints are freely movable, so they are classified as ball and socket or spheroidal joints, sellar or the saddle joints, condylar or bicondylar joints, ellipsoid joints, the hinge joints, pivot or trapezoid joints, plane joints. So these are all the synovial joints. There is the functional classification. Just like you see, have seen just now, you have seen the structural classification. Functional classification is done. How the these ligaments to hold the bones and the cartilage in place. These cartilages of these joints, they also act as shock absorbers. So, for example, you can take the intervertebral discs between the bodies of vertebrae. So, where the cartilage is strengthened by the extra collagen fibers, and the vertebral column can bear the shocks while jumping and doing exercise movements. After the amphiarthrosis, then you come to the diarthrosis. Diarthrosis, these are the synovial joints, which are freely movable joints. As we are doing the functional classification, we see here that some of them, the movement is restricted by the shape of the particular articular surfaces and by the ligaments which hold the bones together. But although they are more freely movable than the other joints, these ligaments, these are of elastic connective tissue, and this synovial joint, it has a fluid-filled cavity between the articular surfaces and it is covered by a articular cartilage. So this fluid which is present between the articular surfaces, it is called as synovial fluid, and it is produced by the synovial membrane which lines the cavity, the articular cavity. But it is not present at the actual articular surfaces, and this covers the ligaments and the tendons which pass through the joint. Now, synovial fluid, it also acts as the lubricant. The form of the articular surfaces here, it controls the type of the movement which takes place at any joint. The movements which are possible here at the synovial joints, they are variable. It can be angular flexion, which decreases the angle between the two bones. It can be extension, which increases the angles between the angle between the two bones. It can be abduction, where the part moves away from midline. Adduction, which brings the part towards the midline. It can be rotatory movement, which turns upon an axis, and it can be circumduction, which moves the extremity of the part round in a circle so that the whole part can inscribe a cone like structure. Then can be gliding type, which where a part slides on another, so a bone, the articular surface of one bone will slide on another. So these are the functional classification. Now coming to the regional classification, so it is classified as per the region where the joints are present. So here it is classified like in the skull, immovable type of joints, in vertebral, slightly movable type of joints, and limbs, it is differently movable joints. So in this way the regional classification is done. Then according to the number of articulating bones, also the classification of joint is done. Like simple joint, where only two bones articulate, for example the interphalangeal joints. Then this other type is the compound joint. Compound is multiple, so more than two bones articulate within one capsule, like for example elbow joint. Then in elbow joint you will find that the radius and ulna, upper ends and the lower end of the humerus, they articulate, so three bones are there. So example elbow joint. Then you have the wrist joint. These are the compound joints. Then complex joint. Complex joint, when a joint cavity is divided by an intra-articular disc, for example the temporomandibular joint and the sternoclavicular joint, where there is an intra-articular disc between the articular surfaces at the joint cavity, and it is divided into compartments. Then the structural classification, which is most commonly followed, and whenever the joints are described, mostly the structural classification is followed. Coming to the fibrous joints. So in fibrous joints, you'll find that the bones are joined by fibrous tissue, and these joints are either immovable or permit a slight degree of movement, and they are grouped again into three subtypes. So what are these three subtypes? We will see accordingly. The sutural type, sutures. So these are peculiar to the skull and these are immovable. And according according to the shape of the bony margins, the sutures can be plain, that is as seen in the internasal sutures between the two nasal bones. It can be serrate, that is like in the example you can take the interparietal suture between the two parietal bones, or the squamous type is seen. These are all sutural examples of sutural joints. So squamous, for example, you can take the temporoparietal suture and denticulate seen in the lambdoid suture. Now coming to skindylosis type of joints. So this is present usually between the rostrum of the sphenoid and upper border of the vomer bone. So in between these two bones, you will find the skindylosis type of joint. Also, a neonatal skull revealing the fontanelles, which are temporary in nature. Almost at 6, you will find the specific points of sutures in the newborn skull are membrane-filled gaps, and these are called as fontanelles. So these allow the underlying brain to increase in size. So there are the anterior fontanelles, posterior fontanelles. So anterior fontanelle is used to judge the hydration of the infant. Also, in other conditions, clinical conditions, the anterior fontanelle is used for diagnosis. All these fontanelles become the bone by 18 months of age. So, this is about the skindylosis. Then coming to syndesmosis. Syndesmosis, the bones are connected by means of interosseous ligament. For example, you can take the inferior tibiofibular joint, between the tibia and fibula at the interior ends. And gomphosis. Gomphosis is the peg and socket type of joint. So there's a peg and a socket which fit into each other. For example, the root of the tooth in its bony socket. So that's the gomphosis type. So these are the three main types: skindylosis, syndesmosis, and gomphosis. Now, coming to the cartilaginous type of joints. In this type of joints, the bones are joined by the cartilage, and these are primarily two types, that is primary cartilaginous joints, and you'll find the secondary type of cartilaginous joints. So let us see the primary cartilaginous joints. So the primary cartilaginous joints, these are the synchondrosis or the hyaline cartilage joints. The bones here are united by a plate of hyaline cartilage so that the joint becomes immovable and strong. And these joints are temporary in nature because after a certain age, the cartilaginous plate becomes replaced by the bone. So what happens is a condition called as synostosis. Syn means joining of the bone. Osteosis is bone. So synostosis, this condition develops and the cartilage gets replaced by bone. For example, the joint between epiphysis and diaphysis of a growing long bone. Then the sphenoccipital joint is also one of the examples of synostosis. First chondrosternal joint, then costochondral joints. These are all the examples of synostosis. Then coming to the secondary cartilaginous joints, which are also called as symphysis or fibrocartilaginous joints. Here, the articular surfaces, these are covered by a thin layer of hyaline cartilage, and they get united by disc of fibrocartilage. These joints, they are permanent and persist throughout life. In this respect, you'll find that the symphysis menti, it is a misnomer because it's a synostosis. So you should not be confused that symphysis menti can be a secondary cartilaginous joint. Typically, the secondary cartilaginous joints occur in the median plane of the body. This is one point to remember. Secondary cartilaginous joints occur in the median plane of the body and permit limited movements due to the compressible pad of fibrocartilage, as seen in the pubic symphysis and manubriosternal joints. Here you will find that the thickness of fibrocartilage is directly related to the range of movement. The secondary cartilaginous joints, they may represent any intermediate stage in the evolution of the synovial joints. The examples of these secondary cartilaginous joints are symphysis pubis, manubriosternal joint, intervertebral joints between the vertebral bodies. So all these joints are found in the median plane of the body. So it's a very excellent example to remember the secondary cartilaginous joints. Now coming to the synovial joints, these are the most evolved and therefore most mobile types of joints. And the characteristics of synovial joints are the articular surfaces, these are covered by hyaline articular cartilage, which like fibrocartilage. In certain membrane points you'll find that fibrocartilage is also present. Articular cartilage, it is avascular, non-nervous and elastic. It is lubricated with the synovial fluid, and the cartilage, it provides slippery surfaces for free movements like ice on ice type movement you'll find. So it has lubrication and freely moves, that is why it's called as ice on ice type movement. It is found in the, especially in the synovial joints. The surface of the cartilage shows fine undulations filled with synovial fluid. And between the articular cartilages, there is a joint cavity filled with the synovial fluid. And the cavity may be partially or completely subdivided by an articular disc or meniscus. Now the joint is surrounded by the articular capsule, which is made up of fibrous capsule, which is lined by the synovial membrane. And because of its rich nerve supply, the fibrous capsule is very sensitive to the stretches which is imposed by the varied movements. This is what sets up the appropriate reflexes to protect the joint from any spray. And this is what is called as the watchdog action of the capsule. And this is the speciality of the synovial joint. So there is a defensive mechanism to provide the proper reflexes and protect the joint from any spray. The fibrous capsule is further reinforced by capsular or the true ligaments representing the thickening of fibrous capsule. So in some of the joints you will find this kind of fibrous thickenings, which are called as the capsular or true ligaments. Then the accessory ligaments, which are distinct from the fibrous capsule, which may also be present intracapsular or extracapsular. The synovial membrane lines whole of the interior of the joint, except for the articular surfaces covered by the hyaline cartilage. And this membrane, it secretes a slimy viscous fluid, which is also called as synovia or synovial fluid, because of which the lubrication of the joint is possible and it is necessary for the free movement. And it is also nourishing the articular cartilage. The viscosity of this fluid is due to the hyaluronic acid, which is secreted by the cells of synovial membrane. There is a varying degree of movements which is permitted by the synovial joints. So because of all these factors, there is a varied movement, also lubrication possible because of the synovial fluid. Further, there is classification of synovial joints and how these are classified. They are classified like synovial, plain synovial joints, where articular surfaces are more or less flat. So that's why it is called as plain synovial joints. And these provide gliding movements in various directions. For example, in the intercarpal joints, intertarsal joints, joints between articular processes of vertebra, cricothyroid joint, cricoarytenoid joints, the superior tibiofibular joints, intercondral joints, that is between 5 to 9 ribs, and costovertebral joints, costotransverse joints, acromioclavicular joints with the intra-articular disc, carpometacarpal joints except the first one, and tarsometatarsal joints, intermetacarpal joints, intermetatarsal joints, chondrosternal joints, except the first one, and the sacroiliac joints. All these joints provide a slight gliding moments. So these are the plane synovial joints. All these are the examples of plane synovial joints. Now coming to the second one, that is the hinge joints, also called as gingly mae. And here, articular surfaces are fully shaped, and these are strong collateral ligaments. Movements are permitted in one plane around the transverse axis. For example, elbow joint, ankle joint, interphalangeal joints. These are the examples of the hinge joints. Third type is the pivot joints or trochoid joints. Here you find that the articular surfaces, they comprise of a central bony pivot or also peg-like structure, which is surrounded by an osteoligamentous ring. So movements are permitted only in one plane around a vertical axis. And examples of these kind of joints, the pivot joints, are the superior and inferior radioulnar joints and median atlanto-axial joint. Because the superior radioulnar joint, you'll find it is present in a ring. Okay, so that's a kind of pivot. Also, median atlanto-axial joint. They are of a similar form of a pivot joint. Now, fourth type is the condylar joints, also bicondylar joints, they are called as. And here you find the articular surfaces include two distinct condyles. One is a convex male surface fitting into reciprocally concave female surface. The concave fitting into convex surface, which are also sometimes called as condyles, like in the tibia. These joints, they permit movements mainly in one plane around a transverse axis, but partly in another plane, that is a kind of rotation around the vertical axis. Now, examples of these kind of joints, condylar joints, are the knee joint, right and left jaw joints, that is temporomandibular joints. These are the bicondylar or condylar joints examples. Fifth type is the ellipsoid joints. Here, the articular surfaces include an oval, convex and male surfaces fitting into a elliptical concave female surface. There is a free movement possible because of this kind of articulation, and it is permitted around both the axis. The flexion and extension is possible around the transverse axis. Abduction and adduction is possible around the anteroposterior axis. And this is the ellipsoid joint. Now, combination of movements may also produce circumduction. Typical rotation around a third vertical axis may not occur. Now, this kind of movements are possible at the wrist joint, metacarpophalangeal joints, atlanto-occipital joints. Now, sixth type is saddle joint, also called as sellar joints. So, articular surfaces here are reciprocally concavo-convex. So, both are similar in shape and size, and reciprocally they are similar. And movements are similar to those permitted by an ellipsoid joint, with some additional rotation called as conjunct rotation around the third axis. But these cannot occur independently. For example, you can take the first carpometacarpal joint. First carpometacarpal joint is at the thumb, and sternoclavicular joint, and the calcaneocuboid joint, incudomalleolar joint between the femur and the patella, intra-articular disc, then it's also called as squamotympanic fissure, tympanic plate, that is intra-articular disc at this place. All these provide the movements by ellipsoid joint with some rotation. The articular disc is complete in the sternoclavicular joint at the acromion, and Articular disc may sometimes be perforated, like seen in the costoclavicular ligament. Conoid and trapezoid parts of the coracoclavicular ligament. So all these are the examples. Now coming for the saddle variety of metacarpal bone of the thumb, that is seen in the trapezium base of the first metacarpal and first carpometacarpal joint, which is also saddle variety. So this kind of examples are seen in the saddle variety. Now we come to the seventh type, that is the ball and socket, which is also spheroidal, also called as spheroidal joints. So here the articular surfaces include a globular head, spherical head, which is also called as the male surface, and it fits into cup-shaped socket, which is called as the female surface. So here the moments are indefinite. They occur around a number of axes and it has one common center. So these examples of these moments can be like flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, medial rotation, lateral rotation, circumduction, and all these movements occur quite freely. Now examples of the ball and socket joints can be shoulder joint, hip joint, callocalcaneo-navicular joint, incudo-stapedial joint. These are all the ball and socket examples. Now coming for the classification and movements of the synovial joints. All these are termed in the human kinesiology. Human kinesiology, it is the study of geometry of surfaces and their associated movements. That is the total study of the movements taking place at the joints. Coming to the explanation for the male surface and female surface, which has been frequently related in the above topics. You know? So male surface means what? It's an articulating surface which is larger in surface area, and it is always concave in all directions. Convex in all directions. So that is the male surface. Whereas female surface, when you say it's an articulating surface, which is smaller and concave in all directions. So the male surface fitting into the female surface. Now the simple joints, these are defined as the joints with only two articulating surfaces, having a male and a female surface. Whereas compound joints, joints possessing more than one pair of articulating surfaces. And degrees of freedom means number of axes at which a bone can move freely in a joint. That is degrees of freedom. So you find a variety of degrees of freedom in variety of joints. Different joints, you have different kinds of degrees of moments. What do you relate by uniaxial? Uniaxial means a movement of a bone at a joint is limited to one axis. That is with one degree of freedom. That is uniaxial. For example, interphalangeal joints. That is one of the examples. You will find that there is a flexion and extension, okay, in the interphalangeal joints. In the biaxial joints, there will be two degrees of freedom, like in the wrist joint. Then multiaxial joints. There are three axes along with the intermediate positions. Also, you can see the example shoulder joint. Then translation, that is gliding or sliding movement of one articular surface over the other. So these are the different degrees of the movements. And coming to the movements and mechanism of joints, there are a variety of movements. Angular movements are there, where the movement leads to demanutation or increase in the angle between the two adjoining bones. So how these kind of angular movements happens? Like in the flexion and extension, you will find that there is a bending or straightening respectively at the joint. And in abduction and adduction, you will find the movement away and towards the median plane can happen. In circumduction, you will find that a long bone circumscribes a conical space, so it moves in a form of a cone, in a circular way. And rotation. Rotation means a bone moves around a longitudinal axis. And adjunct rotation means independent rotations, like a locking of the knee joint. And conjunct rotation means rotations which accompany another movement, other movements, like in the first metacarpal, in the first carpometacarpal joints. So this is what you find in the movements. Now coming to the shape of articular surfaces, the common shapes of the articular surfaces usually find is ovoid, that is when concave, okay, female ovoids, and you'll find convex male ovoids. Then there are the cellar or saddle shaped. These are convex in one plane and concave in the perpendicular plane. So both sides you'll find the different shapes. Then the mechanical axis of a bone and the movement of a bone. It is the reference point around which the joint mechanics can be studied and around which the most of the habitual conjunct rotation happens. Then there is a spin and the swing. Spin means the simple rotation around the bone's stationary mechanical axis happens. It happens like a spin, that's why the term spin. And swing, any other displacement of the bone and its mechanical axis apart from the spin is called as swing. Now swing may be pure or impure, like swing plus element of spin can happen. These are all the normal movements of the bone at the joints. There is another condition called as ovoid of motion. Ovoid of motion means the imaginary surface which would include all the possible paths of a point on the mechanical axis at some distance from its related joint. Then there is the cardinal swing, when the mechanical axis moves in the shortest pathway when the bone moves, and the arcuate swing, that is when the mechanical axis moves in the longest pathway along with the bony movement. Then there is the co-spin. Co-spin means the effect of the adjunct rotation is additional to the rotation. Then just opposite to that is the anti-spin, that is adjunct rotation which has a nullifying effect on the rotation. So all these coordinate together to provide the required movement. Here not only the surfaces of the bone but additionally the ligaments and the muscles do also play a very vital role. Basic components of the movements of the synovial joints, these are the spin, sliding and rolling. So spin, it occurs around a fixed mechanical axis. Slide, it occurs during the sliding movement and the mechanical axis of the joint and both ends of the moving bone, they move both in the same direction. The transverse axis of movement is not fixed and it undergoes gliding or translation for linear movement. Then third one is the rolling type of movement. In rolling movement, one end of the mechanical axis moves in a particular direction and the other end it moves in the opposite direction. And transverse axis of movement is almost fixed. So this resultant movement is like rolling along an arm. And rolling and sliding occur together in the knee joint. So it's an excellent example to see this kind of movement. Now joint positions are closed back position. Then the joint surfaces become completely congruent, that are similar in the shape, and their area of contact is maximal. They are tightly compressed, and in this position, the fibrous capsule and the ligaments, they are maximally spiralized and tense. So no further movement is possible. The surfaces also cannot be separated by any disruptive forces. The articular surfaces are liable to trauma. So you will find that mostly when the joint positions are closely packed, at that time there is a tendency that there can be liability for trauma. If the joints are loose packed, all other positions of incongruency where you'll find examples like least factor position, like in shoulder, semi-abduction, that will be found loose fat, and in hip, semi-flexed, okay, or semi-abducted position, in the knee, semi-flexed position, in the ankle, plantar flexion. So okay, on these conditions we find that there is a loose factor position. Now factors reflex contraction of antagonist muscles, they are responsible for this kind of positions. Due to stimulations of mechanoreceptors in the articular tissues, the tension of the ligaments, and approximately the soft nerves. All these are responsible for the different positions of the joints. As I explained earlier, the muscle and the ligaments are responsible for the movement, also for the closed back or loose back positions of the joints. There is another factor which is very important, is the lubrication of the synovial joint. So one of the factors is the synovial fluid, which is very much helpful for the lubrication. It is secreted by the synovial membrane and it is sticky and viscous in the presence of the hyaluronic acid. That is what serves as the main function of the lubrication of the joint. It also nourishes the articular cartilage. Further, the hyaline cartilage is there, which covers the articular surfaces and possesses the inherent slipperiness, like ice on ice movement it produces because of the slippery surface. Then is the intra-articular fibrocartilages. Articular discs are the menisci, complete or incomplete. Then all these help in spreading the synovial fluid throughout the joint cavity and also on the articular surfaces. Now examples here, you can find temporomandibular joint is an excellent example where the sliding type of movement happens because of the presence of the synovial fluid. Then Heversian fatty pads are also there. These are present because of the Heversian glands, which occupy extra spaces in the joint cavity between the incongruous bony surfaces. If the bony surfaces are not congruent, the Heversian fat pads help to provide that extra space for movement. All of them are covered with a synovial membrane, and this is what helps to spread the synovial fluid. Then there is another structure called as bursa. Bursa, it's a bag which is filled with the synovial fluid, and it is in relation to the joints and the bones and present in between them, and it prevents the friction. Now because of the overactivity or the movements, there can occur a condition called as bursitis, that is the inflammation of the bursa. Then you have the blood supply to the synovial joints. The articular and the epiphyseal branches are there, which are given off by the neighboring arteries, and they form a periarticular arterial plexus that is surrounding the joints. There are numerous vessels from this plexus which pierce the fibrous capsule, and then they form a vascular plexus in the deeper parts of the synovial membrane. And the blood vessels of the synovial membrane, they terminate around the articular margins in a fringe of looped anastomosis, which is termed as circulus vasculosus. So it forms a circle around the joint, and then from there are the different branches arising, and they pierce the synovial membrane and terminate into articular margins. Now this supplies to the capsule, the synovial membrane and the epiphysis, and the articulous cartilage is avascular. After the epiphyseal fusion, these communications between the circulus vasculosus and the end arteries of metaphysis, they get established, and they minimize the chances of osteomyelitis in the metaphysis. This is about the blood supply to the joints, synovial joints. Now coming to the nerve supply of synovial joints, muscle and the ligaments, they have the rich nerve supply, and that's what makes it more sensitive to pain. The synovial membrane has a poor nerve supply, and that is why it is insensitive to pain. The articular cartilage is non-nervous and also totally insensitive. The articular nerves, they contain sensory and autonomic fibers, and some of the sensory fibers, they are proprioceptive in nature. These are sensitive to position, that is what it means, and the movement. And they are concerned with the reflex control of the posture and locomotion. Other sensory fibers are sensitive to pain as well. And autonomic fibers, these are vasomotor or vasosensory. The joint pain, it is often diffuse, whereas it spreads to or radiates to other parts, so it's often diffuse, and it may be associated with nausea, vomiting, slowing of pulse. There can be fall in the blood pressure, and this pain commonly causes reflex contraction of muscles, which will fix the joint in a position of maximum comfort. Like any visceral pain, the joint pain is also referred to the uninvolved joint. Second point, you can see the principles of distribution of nerves to the joint was first described by Hilton. That's why it's called as Hilton's law, and it states that a motor nerve to the muscle acting on the joint tends to give a branch to that joint capsule and another branch to the skin covering the joint. So the concept of innervation of a joint was first described by the Hilton. Later on, it was more evolved by Gardner. Gardner said that each nerve innervates a specific region of the capsule, and that the part of the capsule which is rendered part by the given muscle, which is innervated by the nerve supply by its tendons. Thus, the pattern of innervation is concerned with the maintenance of efficient stability to this joint. One of the mechanism, you can see, is protective in function, provide the stability to maintain the tautness of the joint. Now coming to the lymphatic drainage of the synovial joints, there is lymphatic. So this lymphatics form a plexus in the sub-intima of the synovial membrane, and they drain along the blood vessels to the regional lymph nodes. So the stability of the synovial joint, how the stability of the joint is maintained. There are various factors which maintain the stability for a joint. First is the muscles. So the tone of the different groups of muscles which act on that joint is very important, and it is the indispensable factor in maintaining the stability. So without the muscles, the knee joint or the shoulder joint would not be stable. Even the arches of the foot, they would collapse if the muscles and ligaments are not present. So the ligaments, the importance of ligaments, they are important to prevent any over movement. So they guard the joints against the sudden accidental stresses. However, they do not help against any continuous strain, because once stretched, they tend to remain elongated. So one has to be careful during the strains. So that is where the ligaments get involved. In this respect, the elastic ligaments, that is the ligament of Leva and ligaments of the joints of auditory opticals, are more superior to the common white fibrous ligaments. They can sustain that stress and strain. Coming to the bones. Bones, they help in maintaining the stability only in the firm type of joints like the hip and ankle. Otherwise, in most of the joints, you'll find that like in shoulder joint, knee joint, sacroiliac, the role of the joints is negligible to maintain the stability, because they are themselves this framework of the joint. Now coming to the clinical anatomy, intervertebral disc, it forms the secondary cartilaginous joint between the bodies of the vertebra. So if the nucleus pulposus of the part of the disc gets protruded backwards, it may press on the spinal nerve, leaving out from the intervertebral foramen. So when it is pressed, the condition is known as herniation of the disc or disc prolapse. So if the disc prolapse occurs in the lumbar or the sacral nerve, there is a radiating pain in the lower limb, and that condition is called as sciatica, because it presses over the sciatic nerve and that kind of pain occurs. The joints may get dislocated also. So the end of one of the bones gets out of its socket. That's what is called as dislocation. Another condition is called as subluxation, where one end of the bone partially leaves the socket. So it's a that's called as subluxation, partially dislocated. Another condition related to bones, joints, is the rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever. This rheumatic fever, it causes splitting pains in the joints, accompanied by streptococcal pharyngitis, and it is mostly temporary pain in the joints. The toxins of the bacteria may affect the mitral wall or of the heart or the kidneys. The kidneys may get affected. That's the rheumatic fever related to the joints. Rheumatoid arthritis is also one condition. The inflammatory systemic disease, which involves the synovial membrane, so all the small joints of the hands, and due to the chronic inflammatory process, there is a deformity of the fingers. This is the rheumatoid arthritis. Another condition is osteoarthritis, which is a degenerative condition, especially of the large weight-bearing joints. The articular cartilage wears out, degenerates, and there is a formation of peripheral osteophytes. The patient feels a lot of pain due to the rubbing of the bones together during the movements, because the articular cartilage is eroded, it's worn out, and there is a terrible pain. The degenerative changes or spondylitis can also occur in the cervical spine, which leads to narrowing of the intervertebral foramen, again causing the pressure on the spinal nerve. Also, there's another condition that's called as disc prolapse. Disc prolapse also leads to sciatica. Then subluxation and dislocation can also happen in the vertebras, intervertebral discs. There can be injury to various structures in the joints. At times, there can be in the knee joint, the medial meniscus may get injured. And in that case, it has to be removed by the operative procedure. Then metaphysis, we'll find there can be the ends of the diaphysis or the shaft, which is the actively growing end of the bone. In these joints, we'll find that the capsule enclosing the metaphysis. In such joints, infection can happen, okay, from the metaphysis, which will reach the joint cavity, and it can cause septic arthritis. Then there may be fractures in the joint spaces, leading to collection of blood and broken pieces of the ends of the bone in the joint cavity. Suppose the joints have been diseased for a long time with no hope of recovery, these can be replaced. The x-ray showing replaced hip joints, you can find it in the x-rays also, the condition, okay, the abnormalities can be found out and diagnosis can be made. Stiffness of joints also related to the weather. So the viscosity of the synovial fluid increases with the fall in the temperature. So that's what accounts for the stiffness of the joints in the cold weather. So there will be stiffness and pains in the cold weather. Many of the people complain, isn't it? And then mobility of the joint in itself is an important factor in promoting the lubrication. That's why mobility, that's why people do the exercises, do the movements only to promote the lubrication. So mobility of joint itself is an important factor in promoting the lubrication. Thus, the stiffness of joints experienced in the morning gradually passes off as the movements are resumed. That is one of the conditions which many of the patients who come to us, they complain that there is stiffness in the morning, and as they wake up and do the movements, then the stiffness goes away. So that is one of the anatomical factors which is related to the weather and also related to the lubrication.
The neuropathic joint is the result of its complete denervation. So all the reflexes are eliminated and the joint is left unprotected and liable to mechanical damage. So a neuropathic joint shows painless swelling, excessive mobility, bone destruction, and the diseases which cause this kind of neuropathic joint are leprosy, tapes dorsalis and syringomyelia. So this is all about the cartilages and the joints and its types. This is Dr. Rajeshwari Rapata signing off. Until we meet again in the next episode, stay tuned. Till then, we'll continue the further topics in the coming episodes.